How often is a find damaged when it's being taken out of the ground?
What archaeological discoveries would I most want to tell Mick Aston about?
And when was the last time archaeology made you cry?
Hello and welcome to the Time Team podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams. Today is all about answering the questions that Time Team members have been asking on Patreon. There's also Helen's find coming up later where I introduce an object with a story to tell. And this time it's related to what we were talking about last week about Stonehenge. Well, it's very tangentially related. I say it's related, but you may disagree when you hear about what it is.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to that. Yes, lots to get through today. So let's dive straight in with a question from Kathy, who says this: we have seen the incredible caution used to lift key finds from the digs, and it is always a heart in mouth moment. I remember on the second princely burial when you were lifting the sword, and I'm just thinking, please don't drop it. You have visions of it just snapping in two. It is a heart in mouth moment. Helen, says Kathy, have you ever seen an amazing find lost due to mishandling or just because it was too delicate to survive the extraction?
Gosh, yes. Well, that is a tricky one. Oh, well, it could be a potentially embarrassing one. But I think what Kathy's, what she's asking about really is the things that got away. And one of the things that you get used to in archaeology is that nearly everything has got away. The things that you manage to keep, to preserve, are actually really rare. And that's for two reasons. Now, the first and the most important really is that pretty much all archaeological deposits, rather than finds, they're too delicate to survive excavation anyway. So if you imagine you've got the build-up of dark earth above an abandoned Roman town, or something like the buried soil beneath a burial mound or a medieval castle mound or something, you can excavate that, you can interrogate it, but you can't do it perfectly and totally. The precise relationships between things like the stones, the maybe the carbonized seeds, the tiny particles of soil, that can't be preserved. And because of that, we say that excavation is an inherently destructive business. And all archaeologists learn this very, very fast. Now, the only way that you can preserve even a tiny bit of a deposit is by knocking an aluminium box into, or sometimes people use plastic guttering, into the section. And that's called a monolith sample or a Kubiena box. Mm-hmm. And even when you've done that, once you examine your monolith sample, you end up destroying it by examining it. Now, you might think that finds would be completely different because they're solid and so on, but there is, in fact, a kind of slight continuum between a deposit and a find. So if you've got something like a midden that's full of shells and hazelnuts and so on, or you've got a tangle of grave goods all tangled up in something that might be decayed textile or wood or whatever, you've got something that's both deposit and find. It's both soil and objects all together. And so that's going to be partly destroyed and partly kept. And if you end up with an object that doesn't survive excavation, it tends to be thought of as more of a deposit. So if you've got textile that's rotted away and become a deposit, or perhaps the best example is maybe the Sutton Hoo ship, where the wood has rotted away totally and just become dark soil. That doesn't survive the excavation, but we take a sample, we do what we can. We just don't think too much about what might have been. We do what we can. We can't preserve every single total particle. Another concept that we keep in our minds is something that's usually called the seven stages of sampling bias. Now, anything that's got seven stages, like a rainbow or whatever, is going to be a bit artificial because seven is the right number, apparently. That's why Isaac Newton added violet and indigo to his rainbow rather than just having purple, because six is the wrong number. Seven is like a mystical number. So I'm not going to take you through all seven because I don't really believe all seven exist. But the first one is most things are not lost or thrown away. That's why they don't make it into the archaeological record. They simply wear out. Wooden spoons, dishcloths, the stuff of everyday life, it just wears out. Then, secondly, not everything that is thrown away is going to survive in the soil. So things made of wood, bone and antler, that kind of thing, they often just rot away. And in the past, that was often most things. Then the third one is, even if it's going to survive, it might not make it through to the present day to be found. I mean, it survives notionally, but say something drops off a cliff or if it's ploughed to bits, it might be the kind of thing that would survive, but just because of bad luck, it doesn't. Now, these catastrophes, they go on and on and on. But number five is, even if it is dug up, it might not be recovered safely. And I suppose that's the stage that Kathy's asking about. The short answer really is, we don't worry too much about it. We do what we can. And although there are always rumours of things that were lost due to mishandling, they don't make their way into a published source. So they're always just rumours. And I am going to plead the Fifth Amendment here. I don't feel up to sharing any of the rumours that I have heard, especially when they involve our most august cultural institutions and people who are doing their best. Conservators are all absolutely brilliant and they do extraordinary jobs, but they're pragmatic people and they're used to gluing things back together again when they have collapsed or broken. Even there, sometimes there will be accidents and these things just happen. I do think that the Sutton Hoo ship is the best example of this. It was an artifact. It just became part of the soil. That's been lost forever. We've got bits of plaster cast, not all of it. We've got photographs, etc., etc. We've got now the reconstructed version, but that actual ship has gone forever. It's sad, but it's unavoidable.
And just take me through what goes through your mind then when you are tasked with taking something so precious, so one of a kind out of the ground. That sword, for example, do you get nervous about it or have you done it so many times now that you just sort of, you're in the zone and you know what you're doing?
No, I don't know what I'm doing. I know that there is, if there's a conservator there, if there's somebody like Pieta, who is so much missed, she knew what she was doing. She'd done it hundreds of times before. She's trained. She's confident. You defer to her. She will instruct you on what to do. She's in charge. It's above my pay grade. But there are cases where there's nobody else there. In the country of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And sometimes I'm the one-eyed man. And I do what I can. You just do what you can. And you know that you're the best person at that moment. So if it's 5 o'clock on a Sunday evening in February and somebody's called me out for something that they found while metal detecting, I do the best I can. And I know that it's better to have me there than nobody there. So that's all you can do. You can't beat yourself up about not being perfect, because archaeology is never perfect. It's always a tension between what you've got the time and the money and the resources to do, what is desperately needed because it's currently being, I don't know, dug away or eroded away or falling off a cliff or whatever. You salvage what you can and you learn to lower your expectations, I'm afraid.
I could just imagine my hands would be shaking, that'd be all clammy. I would be a terrible person to do it. I'm really bad at little fiddly things as well. I get really sort of, I just can't do it. So I'm glad it's you and not me. And I'm glad it's a conservator as well, the experts in this sort of thing. Great question, Kathy. Thank you very much for it. Here comes another one then ahead of Helen's find. And it comes from Leanne, who says, do the folks ever marvel at how much more they know now from experience than they did in the early years? In a way, this sort of links, doesn't it? We're talking about the, you know, being an experienced archaeologist. Leanne goes on, and do they ever consider that their current knowledge may have made their earlier work easier? So I suppose this is now, I guess it's a question of hindsight, isn't it? If you knew then what you knew now, would your job then have been easier?
Well, yeah, I wonder this a bit. I do feel now that I ought to know much more than I used to, because we all keep on learning all through our lives. But I think we also do an awful lot of forgetting just so we can fit it all in. I've lost a huge amount of knowledge over the years, or at least accessible knowledge that I can remember. And I think I've been pruning the stuff that I don't necessarily need. So you just end up with a different kind of knowledge. Thinking about things that you might have done differently had you got this extra knowledge? Well, I look back to the work I did for my doctoral thesis. For that, I was trying to find Roman parallels to Anglo-Saxon objects to find where the inspiration came for new fashions in the 7th century. And I think, gosh, I know so much about Roman objects now. If only I had known then what I know now, I wouldn't have chosen those objects to illustrate. I would have been able to find maybe better parallels. But the problem also is that if I knew then what I know now, I wouldn't have had the nerve to suggest it. It would have been so hedged about with ifs and buts and ands and possibly a maybe and so on. I think it's a really good thing that I did have this very shallow knowledge, because I was able to suggest a broad theme, which I still think is fundamentally right. But sometimes you've got so much detail that you can't see the wood for the trees. Sometimes in some parts of your life, you need that sureness that comes with being young and ignorant. And sometimes you need the wisdom that comes from being older and more experienced. So it's horses for courses, really.
What do you think you would tell your younger self now if you could?
Oh, I think that I would say be more patient, that things will be discovered that will make things easier. There will be new discoveries that sort things out, and you don't need to worry about things. Although, having said that, there are other discoveries that have made things that you didn't think were important extra important. And you think, oh, I wish I'd... Because of this business of archaeologists only ever seeing things once, because you either destroy it as you're excavating it, or with my day job with the Portable Antiquities Scheme, you never see an object again. And you think, oh, if only I turned it over and looked at the back and realised that was equally important. You know, you learn these things as you go on. So it's difficult to think of an example, because I do think I'm one of those people that just kind of says, oh, on to the next thing, rather than looking back. I like to think that things are easier now, but they probably aren't.
Well, it's a good way to think, isn't it? It's better than thinking they're harder now. So that's very good. Well, two really, really thought-provoking questions so far. And we shall get back to the questions in just a moment, because I've got a couple more to bring you. Equally as thought-provoking, I would say. But right now, let's do Helen's Find, shall we? And this is the bit of the podcast where Helen brings an object, an ancient object often found through archaeology, to your attention and talks about its significance. And as always, I have put a link to this particular object so you can go and look at it for yourself. It's over on the Portable Antiquities Scheme. You'll find the link to the object we're talking about in the description of this podcast. So what are we talking about this time then?
Well, Martin, I thought that after last week and that exciting news about the oldest solstice alignment found in Britain, now you could call that a kind of sun dial, and I thought I'd delight you with something similar, but much, much, much later. It's almost like the latest known sundial. I mean, I know we have sundials in our garden that are kind of decorative, and there's sometimes up in, there's a couple in Cambridge that you can walk past and look at when it's sunny. But what I want to show you this week is the last kind of sundial that was used as a primary means of telling the time, before watches were cheap and easy. If you get up the record and have a look at the pictures, you can see why they're also called ring dials. So they're pocket sundials. They fit in your pocket. They look like a ring. They're used in the 17th and 18th centuries to roughly tell the time. Now, this one was found in Devon, and it was recorded by our Cornish team. And you can see that it's a ring like a kind of pastry cutter or a cookie cutter, like that kind of thing, like a small cylinder.
Yeah, a lot smaller than you would ever think a sundial would be.
Yeah, it's only about an inch and a half across. Some of them are slightly bigger, but they're all basically the size of the kind of pocket watch that you'd pop into your waistcoat pocket. If you look around the outside, you can see that there's a slot, and that would have held an inner sliding ring that could be moved around in the slot. And that inner sliding ring has a hole in it. You can see that the months of the year are marked along the edge of the slot in two groups. They go from January to June, and then from July to December the other way up. And the thing to look out for is the name Jason, because that spells July, August, September, October, November. So whenever you see Jason written on something old...
doesn't mean it belongs to Jason.
No, it means it's some kind of calendar. And this is before the J. Do you remember talking to Danny Bate about the history of letters? And this is before J turns its corner at the bottom, has its little loop at the bottom.
Right.
So it's I-A-S-O-N. And January is also an I and so on. So you can spot your months, and you've got then lines running through those month letters, running from the month letters up to the slot, which divides each month up into weeks. So you use that to set the date. You turn the sliding ring into the date, and then that gets the hole in the right place for the time of year. Then you have to dangle it from the loop that you can see on the side. I think you'd have a chain or a cord or something through that loop so that you can dangle it and it's free to turn. And you turn it so that the sun's shining through the hole in the sliding ring, the one that you've positioned according to the date. And as if by magic, it casts a tiny little shiny light onto the opposite inside surface of the ring where it is marked with the hours. And those hours you can see in the bottom two photos. So you can use that light to tell what hour it is. You can't tell whether it's AM or PM. I think you were supposed to know that already. But you could tell if it was, say, 2 o'clock or 5 o'clock, or even 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock. I mean, how much practical use they were is a bit of a moot question. You can only tell the hour, and you can only do it as long as the sun is shining, but also if it's not too windy, because the sundial's got to hang still enough. Ultimately, I think these things are, they're technology, they're a gadget. And the thing that we all know about gadgets is they're often more things to show off with. They're not always of brilliant practical use, but you can say, hey, I can tell the time, you know. So these things go out of use straight away when clockwork pocket watches become cheap enough for everybody to have, or for most people to have. So say in the late 18th century, you can look at this and imagine it came from the South Devon coast. And you can imagine somebody on the South Devon coast with their pocket sundial, maybe waiting for their rendezvous with the brandy smugglers or something, who they said they'd be here at 9 o'clock and it's now 10 o'clock. And they're not here. You can imagine it being used for something like that. They're lovely little things, and you can buy reproductions of them, apparently. So you too could compare it, digital watch on the one hand and pocket ring sundial on the other.
I do think that there must have been a lot more waiting around before we had clockwork methods of telling the time, because, you know, how would you really know? I mean, sundials, fine, but again, they're not as accurate, are they? So you could be waiting around for ages. And if you didn't even have one of those, well, how on earth would you know when to meet somebody?
Yeah, I often think about that and wonder whether the fact that we have a watch on our wrists or a phone in our pockets means that we don't have so much of a good idea as to a kind of innate idea as to how time is passing. Yeah, it's those rendezvous, isn't it? That it's those specific times when you say, I'll be there then, we'll do that at this time. Maybe people didn't do that so much. Maybe they said, we'll do it after a certain time or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, I suppose so. And maybe you would have been socialised, you would have been all together in one group. You know, the only people you were ever going to be meeting were probably going to be the people that were just down the street. So you could just go, well, at some point during the day, I'm going to call on them and I'm expecting them to be there. And then you'd have, I suppose, at least two times in the day, if not three, when everybody would experience the same thing at the same time, and that's sunrise and sunset. You wouldn't necessarily know exactly when they were going to happen, but in a way it didn't matter because you just got the visual cue from the sun either being there or not being there. And then I guess midday is the other one, although gauging that exactly might have been a little bit more difficult. But there were things that would tell you when you arrived at a certain time that everybody else would experience. I just find the whole thing very interesting. And how our lives have changed as a result of the advent of clocks.
Yes, I think there's two things there that I would want to explore a bit more, maybe. One would be to talk to people who still live without clocks and find out how they do it. So the ethnographic parallel, if you like. And the other thing that I think could be really useful in this is the writing of the historical novel. So you want your characters to do something and you've got to get them to do it without the technology of today? That's almost like, you know how I'm always talking about Victor Ambrus and his questions that he needed to ask to inform a drawing. Well, the questions that you also need to ask to inform the historical novel, these imaginative exercises are really useful for that kind of thing.
Very, very interesting. And of course, if you've got any thoughts on this, we'd love to hear it. You can get involved right now over on Patreon. If you're a Time Team member, there's a chat that's always going on, really, where you can ask Helen the question or just have you say on the podcast. Just go to patreon.com/timeteamofficial.
This is the Time Team podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams. Back to the questions in just a moment, but I wanted to draw your attention to a Time Team Classics special coming to YouTube on Saturday. And with the 4th of July coming up, and this year, of course, celebrating the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, it's all about the beginnings of the modern-day United States of America.
Yeah, Jamestown, America's birthplace, tells the story of the colonists at Jamestown who went looking for gold and silver. Instead, they found fertile soil, tough conditions, and the beginnings of the world's most powerful nation. So the team retrieves piles of perfectly preserved 17th century pieces, traces the names and life stories of the early American pioneers, and learns why a third died within months of arrival.
It's an absolutely fascinating program. It was a real privilege to be able to visit Jamestown because it is an extraordinary place. It's really easy to think yourself back into the 17th century there, partly because where those English settlers set up camp, it was as foreign to them as it is to us. They were there right at the start of a place that they had no idea about. They seem to have arrived with apparently very little idea of what they were going to be doing or needing. And because they would have had to bring everything over on the ship, they couldn't guarantee to be able to find anything where they arrived. The entire site's like a little time capsule. And one of the really fascinating things is that there's a lot of jetons, these little coin-like counters. There are over 100 of those found at Jamestown. What were they doing there? There's a theory about jetons that they might have been used as small change, but in a community like that, you wouldn't have needed coins. It would all have been done on credit and on trust. So I can only assume that they brought them over because right from the start, they were intending to grow tobacco and send it back to Britain, very lucrative crop tobacco. So they'll have been needing to do accounts over in America. So it really shows that they were going there with this purpose to exploit the land, to seek opportunity. But of course, the other side of the coin, so to speak, is the scale of that death. They clearly didn't expect that there would be helpful people already living there who would feel sorry for them and who would be able to help, which is the case. They were offered help and they didn't seem to be able to take it. They seemed to fall into a kind of groupthink where they all just almost gave up. And they just made a few really awful mistakes as well, digging the well in the wrong place so that the water was slightly salty. They didn't know what food they could eat and what they couldn't. And you just end up feeling so sorry for them. Particularly, I felt the women. You know, I visited there when I had small children, and all I could think of was not only no bakers, no butchers, you had to produce everything yourself, but also no doctors and no midwives. So if you needed help giving birth, you then, you know, just best of luck because you're on your own. So they were so brave, but also they were so foolhardy in many ways. And the feeling you get, I mean, the modern day analogy I keep thinking is like trying to establish a colony on the moon, seems to us, it must have seemed to them. Ironically, establishing a colony in America should have been as easy as pie. It's incredibly fertile, many helpful people who, of course, they didn't bother to listen to. It's the same atmosphere, it's the same soils. The moon is very different, but they seem to have set out with the same mindset that we are using to explore space, which is a pity.
And you can find out all about it by watching Jamestown, America's Birthplace. It's coming to Time Team's YouTube channel on Saturday. Okay, back to the questions. Now two more to go. And this one comes from Karen, who says, having worked so closely with the great Mick Aston, what discoveries that have been made since his untimely death would you be the most excited to tell him about? Would any of those discoveries confirm or negate any of Mick's long-held theories? And Karen just ends by saying, RIP Mick.
So we're coming up to the anniversary of losing Mick quite soon. And I always think he'd have been so fascinated by the test pits that we dig more and more of these days. And this began under Mick because it led directly out of the Big Dig, which was one of his babies. And the test pits are really a new way of gathering data. It's a different kind of data, a different kind of bias comes out of test pits. And if you do enough of it and you've got the right pottery specialists, it can bring these really big new insights, both about kind of large-scale demographics, but also on the small scale, it's things like village layouts and how people lived. Test pits can really tell us about what life was like for most people. So I think he'd have been amazed at how particularly Carenza and Paul Blinkhorn have developed the test pit into a really powerful tool. On the other hand, some of the sites we've looked at recently, there's been a tendency to have high status sites like Sutton Hoo and Broughton Roman Villa and Brancaster, or sites on the great estates of England like Mapperton and so on, because Mick was incredibly emphatic about the underlying point of archaeology. It was all about those who didn't make it into the history books. So he'd have preferred places like Modbury and Norton Disney, where we're looking for ordinary villagers who dropped their rubbish, lived in wooden houses, who were representative of most people in the past. And I think Modbury would have been his total favourite. He'd have been in seventh heaven there because it was a community archaeology project with a really enthusiastic group of people that rediscovered its medieval priory. So they've got a whole new area of research that they can go to now because they've finally got the physical evidence of their medieval priory back. And that was what Time Team helped them to do. So he'd have loved that one. I really missed him at Modbury. We miss his kind of guiding spirit all the time. And he absolutely never lost sight of why we were doing what we do, what the point of it is. Archaeology for the people.
Absolutely. And as somebody who's joined Time Team since Mick's death, what I've been really touched by and I have noticed is how Mick's, that guiding spirit you talk about, Helen, that is still there. Mm. All the time people are, well, what would Mick have done? What would Mick have thought about this? And it still plays into how we think about approaching a site, how we decide whether or not we're going to do a site. His influence on Time Team is still happening to this day. And I think, you know, what a legacy really to have left. A brilliant question, of course, Karen, thank you very much. It leads us on to our final one, and it comes from Michael, who says, when was the last time you were on an excavation and it gave you a proper cry, either in sheer frustration or in the overall joy of the moment? Are you known for welling up, Helen?
Well, yes, I'm a terrible, terrible crier.
I've heard.
I can cry at anything that's sad. I cry continually all the way through funerals, even if they're funerals of people I've never met. I'm very, very vulnerable to sadness, but I never cry in frustration. I just don't get that. I do things like bang my fist on a table. I'm a terrible door slammer.
Oh, yeah.
When I was a teenager, I once slammed my parents' back door so hard I broke the window in it.
Oh no.
Yes, it never makes me cry. So if we're talking about frustration, I think I'm quite a sanguine person about frustration in archaeology. What can be really frustrating, though, is when we're all looking at the geophysics and nobody is listening to what you think about where to put a trench. And I sometimes feel that we're a bit overambitious, that I can almost predict that somebody's going to say, let's put a little tiny trench over this area where all these ditches intersect or something, and then we'll be able to find out the sequence. And what happens is we put a little tiny trench over it, and then we go, oh, that's complicated. Oh, well, I'm not sure that we're going to get all the We've got quite enough time to get all the information out of that trench that there is. Should we just map the top and carry on? And you think, I could have predicted that. We've wasted all this time. Whereas we could have done something simpler and done it better.
I told you so.
Yes. But then you see, I've never been the person who knows the most about this. So I tend to defer to the people who dig every day, you know, people like Matt, who's got an absolutely storied past of excavation. That is something that I just tut and harumph, and I look around the field for a door to slam. There isn't one. but you see, I cry at anything, at any loss. What I've noticed is that I'm particularly weepy in the early morning. If you catch me before lunch, I'm liable to weep at everything. You can give me a slightly sad poem, or maybe even a slightly, you know, mournful picture. I'm away with my weeping. And I had a real problem with this when we did Arkwright's Mill in Manchester, because it was a constant, never-ending story of backbreaking work in the mill and then coming home to cholera. And I just really related to women like me who would be working 12-hour days in the mill. Their mothers would be looking after the children so that they could work, and then they'd come home to find everybody dead of cholera. The lived experience, I mean, you don't really want to talk too much about the details of cholera, but the lived household experience of cholera must have been absolutely unbelievably terrible. And we do need to talk about it. I mean, we need to know about it. We need to talk about it. But it's something that's almost too awful to let into your mind. And I think maybe that's why I prefer archaeology to history, because all of those stories, they've got a huge historical dimension. We know about them because of documentary history. And archaeologically, it's when the moments are, well, if you watch Jamestown, you'll see that at one point we found a little shoe in a well. And knowing from the history all of the awfulness, and then having tangible evidence of that in your hand, a little shoe of maybe a three-year-old child or something. And of course, they probably just grew out of it and chucked it down the well and went on to a happy life. But the likelihood is that they probably didn't. It just epitomises that story of suffering and bravery.
And I suppose it's anything, isn't it, to humanise either the skeletal remains that are found or the people who would have been there, you know, through the objects. And for example, the DNA that we did with the bodies at Cherrington, the princely burial, and yeah, we discovered that they were brother and sister. And it just makes you so much more emotional, because you have an emotional connection, because you know something about them as people. That gets me, because then, yes, I start thinking about how they would have died and how much they loved each other. And it really gets you.
Yes. And when we got the first hint of the DNA analysis of another part of the Cherrington excavation, when we were actually on site, Jackie had a phone call and she said, "We now know that this child..." And we quite often distance them, children, by calling them things like infants and juveniles and sub-adults and that kind of thing. She said, "We now know this child is a boy, so we can now call him the little boy." And George, our director, has a little boy of just the same age as the boy in the grave. The first time we used that term, you know, the little boy, he just had a moment and had to go away for a bit, because you just suddenly feel a fellow feeling with somebody all those hundreds of years ago. I think that's what keeps you going with an Anglo-Saxon cemetery, really. It's that you're bringing these people back to a kind of life. You've got a connection with them. It's a difficult thing to describe. You know, in talking about this, I've just realised that Michael, of course, did also ask about crying with joy, which is another thing that I don't do.
No, I don't think I've ever cried with joy, really.
No, I know people do, but I find it's too joyful.
Yeah, too busy having a good time. Yeah, yes. to be crying. Yeah. Oh, yes. Well, very good. I mean, I know from speaking to members of the production team, by the way, that everybody loves the fact that you're easy to get weeping, because it's all very good on telly, isn't it? People like a bit of emotion.
Well, yes, here's a tip. Catch me in the morning. Give me a Thomas Hardy poem to read, and I won't need to act anything.
Yeah, that's the way. way of it. Some great questions on this episode. So thank you so much if you've got in touch and suggested them. We'll do that again in a couple of weeks' time. Tend to do them every now and again, these episodes where Helen answers questions from Time Team members. If you want to ask a question, you do need to be a Time Team member, and it's really, really easy. And you don't just get to be involved in the podcast, by the way, where you get bonus episodes. For example, there's a bonus episode out right now with Karenza Lewis for some Time Team members. She's going to be, or she's telling you about something very exciting that she's doing very shortly that she wants to invite you to. So you can go and hear that. But you don't just get the bonus and the ad-free episodes of the podcast. There's loads of other things like masterclasses, 3D models, behind the scenes, exclusive access to some of the digs that we do. It's all there for you on Patreon. Patreon.com/timeteamofficial if you want more information on how to become a member.
And next week, there's even more from the world of archaeology, including a trip to Dorset, where a team from Bournemouth University are uncovering something very exciting indeed.
Yes, that is all next week on the Time Team podcast. Until then, have a wonderful week, and we'll speak to you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.